He evokes what we all feel for a fellow man when touched by the sense of our common mortality, our common defenselessness against implacable fate. Text 30. Athena, here was a man supreme in judgment, unsurpassed in action, matched to the hour. Did you ever see a better? Odysseus, none. That is why, foe though he is, I pity his wretchedness, yoked to a terrible fate. I have in view no more his plight than mine. I see the true condition of us all. We live, yet are no more than phantasms, weightless shades. This is the mood of the eighth Pythian. Day creatures, creatures of a day. What is it to be or not to be? Man is a shadow in a dream. It is the mood of Solon in Herodotus when he remarks, man is all accident. It is as old as Odysseus' somber musings in Book 18 of the Odyssey. Earth breeds no creature feebler than man. The moral import of this sentiment in Book 18 we see in Book 22 after the massacre of the suitors, when Eurycleia lets out a whoop of vengeful joy at the sight of the gore spattered about the banquet hall. Odysseus rebukes her. Keep your gloating to yourself, old woman. Shut up, don't yell. It isn't pious to exult over corpses. More successfully than Herodotus, Pindar, or Homer, Sophocles distills moral therapy from the sense of man's brittleness. He shows how it can purge the heart from the toxins of spite and hatred. But when he has done all this, we still want to know, does he see that the Talio is a fraud, its justice a delusion? To this we must reply that he did not even face the question. So we return to Socrates, who did, and reasoned out an answer. So there's still lots of time for discussion.
In your text 2, 3, and 4, it's foes, enemies, plural.
Let me look at this so I see exactly what you're talking about. Okay, 2, 3, and 4.
They're all plural foes.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a slipping somewhere in your lecture, I think, into considering a single foe.
Let me see. Your logic is more subtle, I think.
Some of these texts are talking about the foe of the whole people.
I see. I don't think so. Well, that's a moot. Oh, you see, take Solon.
Yes.
Sweet to friends, bitter to foes. If you're my foe, I'm going to be bitter to you. Exactly how bitter he's going to be, we don't know. But certainly he's not going to be nice to you. Medea. Harsh to foes. You see, it doesn't take a lot of foes. One Jason will do it. And she will kill the two children and his bride-to-be. You see, if we take that to mean national foes, certainly that is untouched. I mean, international feuding is untouched. But, I wouldn't say untouched. It is moderated. That is to say, the application of this principle would certainly abate the worst extremes. Like the thing that was proposed for Mitylene, it didn't go through, but it did go through for Scione, and it did go through for Milos, and so forth. So it would abate the savagery, possible savagery, in returning wrong for wrong. But it wouldn't, it's not a pacifist doctrine, that's for sure. And it has the specific import, it seems to me, is in personal relations. And so far as I can see, This is the crux of it. If someone did, I repeat myself, but I don't know how to put it more simply and more forcefully, if somebody did a nasty thing to me, that is not the slightest moral reason for doing a nasty thing to him. That, it seems to me, goes as deeply as any moral insight can go, because a lot of things come from it. And the assumption, the common assumption is, yes, if somebody did a nasty thing to me, I'm perfectly justified in doing the same to him or her. Yes, Gordon.
In your mention of a passage in Sophocles where you have something that approaches this, but as you say, it's more about compassion, where would you place the famous statement of the theater? Remember when Creon says, quote with death, and her answer is, utoi senectin ala sum finenitu, I was born not to eat but to love.
That's a lovely sentiment. Yeah, absolutely beautiful. And yet, I'm all in favor of elevating Antigone as far as we can on the basis of evidence rather than on the basis of our good feelings for her. I want to go through it. I mean, you know, if I went through the Ajax, and then I find that slight comment in which he takes the Talia for granted in little things. I wonder how it would be if I went through the... I'm not as fortunate as you or some people here who know these things by heart. I'd have to scan it and see how much credit we should give her.
I don't think it is quite Socratic, but it's sort of going halfway.
Oh, I have no objection.
In other words, she is renouncing the kind of justice that...
No, I have no objection to that. It seems to me that it would be most surprising if we got Socrates at a time in which approximations to this line he takes were not to be found. There are, in Herodotus, there are examples. When Pausanias, for example, is approached and requested to maltreat, to desecrate the corpse of the Persian general, I forget who it was, because he had done such horrible things to the corpse of Leonidas. He replies, that's for barbarians, not for Greeks, actually. I don't think his logic is very adequate, is very true to the facts. But anyhow, it's a noble sentiment. And there are other cases like that that one can find. In fact, isn't Xerxes also? Xerxes, I think, is once credited with a similarly, by Herodotus, with a similarly noble sentiment. But I still don't think, I would say the strongest approach to it is this Odysseus, who is so curious. One of the puzzles to me is how Odysseus can be presented as such a morally hard, insensitive character in the Philoctetes and be presented in this way in the Ajax. I mean, has he had a conversion experience? it's very interesting. It seems to me that I can think of no modern parallel in which a character who is in one play changes character, his disposition so violently in another, but others know this can speak to it. But anyhow, other questions? Yes, sir.
Your statement about which is the closest approach to Socrates,
yes, yes,
raises the idea in my mind that what seems essential to the conception that you're insisting upon is the autonomy and the absoluteness of the position.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned autonomy, moral autonomy, as a central implication of Socrates' sexuality and restraint in his pursuit of pleasure and of beauty in your first lecture. And now it seems to me that the question of whom the harm is done to is irrelevant. it doesn't matter whether he harmed me or I harmed him. The question is then harming in itself. Is this not what you're arguing? Harming in itself is a wrong act, and it's irrelevant who is harmed. Do you see what I'm...
I think I see, but I'm not sure.
Does that sound like what you're implying?
I'm not sure I'm implying that. Certainly, to do harm to a human being is to do injustice. That is the basic thing in Socrates. All right? So we mustn't do injustice. In the last analysis, why not, if we are Socrates? Because it would damage my happiness. The last point at which his reasoning stops is this is the final reason for doing anything or refraining from everything, from anything, and that is your own happiness. And that's why I say it's the ethic of the Socratic ethic and the ethic generally accepted in antiquity is so different from modern. Even those modern moralists who elevate happiness to the summum bonum speak of the greatest happiness of the greatest number. I mean, that's not an unfamiliar phrase. You see, in the case of Socrates, and I think he's the founder of this tradition, I don't know of anyone before him who at least is explicit on this point, my happiness is ultimate, the ultimate thing. Now, how are you going to construe your happiness? I mean, that seems like a very, from our point of view, it seems almost patently immoral when you first hear it, this position. Well, if you construe happiness the way Socrates does, you can go a long way. For example, you have ample reason for rejecting the Lex Talionis.
All I mean is that the economy becomes internal.
Certainly. Certainly we can agree on that. Right. Any other question or comment? I guess you all want to go home.